Each year, it is my privilege to produce for you more than 200 Cato Daily podcasts featuring Cato scholars, outside experts, journalists, lawmakers, and others with interesting things to say. And at Cato, we accept no government money. We are entirely funded by private citizens and organizations. That means both Cato and the Cato Daily podcast are completely dependent on your support. To keep the Cato Daily podcast strong and growing, we've launched a new podcast sponsor program for this holiday season. Any and all donations to support the podcast are most appreciated, but at the $1,000 level of support, you'll become a Cato patron sponsor, which means you'll receive all the benefits of patron sponsorship. Additionally, unless you object, I'll personally thank you on the podcast. Cato is a 501c3 charitable organization, which means that your gift is tax deductible to the fullest extent allowed by law. To learn more, visit cato.org/podcast sponsor. That's cato.org/podcast sponsor. And as always, thank you for listening. This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Thursday, December 21st, 2017. I'm Caleb Brown. When the WannaCry malware attack that devastated thousands of computer systems was halted, fingers had already begun pointing at North Korea. But the exploit the hackers used was one that the National Security Agency had known about for some time and only told Microsoft about it just before the attack went live. But the timing of that kind of new, but not really new, announcement that North Korea was responsible is at least curious. Cato's Julian Sanchez comments.
Can you walk us through the details of what this attack looked like? And as I recall, it was very strange and, as you note, not particularly sophisticated.
Right. So WannaCry was a piece of ransomware that hit hundreds of thousands of computer systems around the world in May of 2017. Effectively, what it would do is exploited a vulnerability in Windows server message block protocol, which is basically just a behind-the-scenes protocol that Windows uses to handle printer sharing and file sharing between different computers on the network. So this worm was able to essentially sneak through a gap in that protocol. And when it installed, it would encrypt all the data on someone's hard drive and then try and copy itself to any other vulnerable computers on the network. And then it would demand a payment of between $300 and $600 paid in Bitcoin in order to decrypt those files. Doesn't seem to have made that much money. I saw an estimate that was around $130,000 were actually paid. And unfortunately, there's no evidence that I can see that anyone ever actually got their files back as a result of having paid. So this doesn't really seem to have been a money-making enterprise, though it did cost, by most estimates, billions of dollars in damage just as a result of data being lost or systems having to be essentially wiped and replaced.
In the case of the British National Health Service, this is a very important system to the health of people in Great Britain. So affecting a system like that could have life or death consequences depending on how much damage it does.
Certainly, at least at the very least, delay of treatment just as a result of the confusion imposed. You would hope a critical system like healthcare would have some kind of fallback in the event of some kind of event like this, but you would also hope that a healthcare system would not be using unpatched software. This was a vulnerability that Microsoft had patched in March. So it was just those systems that had not been updated by May, which is quite a lot, as it turns out, that were exploitable. But certainly, you would hope that something that's running with people's healthcare data would install security patches, essentially the second they're released.
So the person who stopped this was himself a hacker who got a look at the code and secured or put a web page up at a particular domain name that
stopped the attack.
That's right. There was what was called a kill switch. You know, the problem with worms is that they tend to spread out of control. I mean, that's what a worm is. It's essentially a self-replicating program. Maybe the first and most famous internet worm in the early 80s sort of shut down a lot of computer systems quite by accident. It had not been intended as something destructive. It was more of a kind of prank or experiment by a young hacker that spun out of control. So in this case, the designer, which consensus seems to be is the North Korean Lazarus Group, had created a kill switch. So before the worm encrypts your data or tries to copy itself, it would check whether a particular website was up. And then if it found that the website had been activated, it would shut itself down instead of encrypting and replicating.
And then he himself found him. He himself was got caught in something for having engaged in some illegal activity as well.
That's right. I think he was accused. I don't remember the details exactly, but of essentially providing services to bad actors. This is one of the sort of difficulties of working in computer security is that the folks you need to catch a thief often themselves have dubious ties, but also, you know, more sympathetically, let's say, the kind of work you need to do to be able to be effective as a security practitioner is often on the borderline. And so there's a lot of security researchers, for example, have complained that the way our federal computer fraud and computer intrusion statutes are written makes it difficult for them to do the kind of things they need to do because it may technically fall afoul of the run afoul of the law, even if their aim is to help improve security and not to cause any damage.
The United States and Great Britain both say that this was a group that has ties to North Korea, and as you say, we don't have any particular reason to doubt that. But why now might be an appropriate question.
Yeah, I mean, the interesting thing here is that almost immediately there were attributions publicly by various sort of private entities to North Korea. There were, I think, in October, the UK made statements to the same effect. So this is something that had been sort of unofficially reported. I think the Washington Post back in June said that the U.S. government had concluded it was North Korea. So the timing of announcing this now seems certainly not to be the fact that new evidence has come to light and they have just concluded that North Korea was responsible, but part of the sort of ongoing I guess diplomatic attempt to play hardball with North Korea, so connected to you know, the full range of tensions between the U.S. and North Korea.
And the lesson here, as a matter of network and computer security, is just what? Gird your loins?
Well, the personal level lesson, I think, is just update your system as soon as any kind of security update is released. Again, this is not a huge span of time, but this is something that Microsoft patched after being tipped off by NSA back in March. And so you had to have a system that hadn't been updated, hadn't installed the security update for essentially a couple months to be vulnerable. The macro takeaway, of course, is that NSA should rethink how it stockpiles vulnerabilities. I mean, the interesting thing about this attribution is this was announced essentially by an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal by one of the administration's cybersecurity advisors, and nowhere in this rather long article does it even mention that the vulnerability in question, called Eternal Blue, which has been used in both WannaCry and a later piece of malware called NotPetya that targeted systems in Ukraine and was probably launched by Russia, this Eternal Blue vulnerability is something that got into the wild because the NSA had for 5 years been sitting on it and using it for their own purposes to break into foreign systems for intelligence purposes. And we know there was a group, again, probably Russian, called the Shadow Brokers that the previous summer had released somewhat embarrassingly a stockpile of stolen NSA vulnerabilities. And then, so the timeline here is somewhere around January or February, NSA essentially decides it's finally time to tell Microsoft about this Windows vulnerability they've been using for some time. Microsoft sort of surprisingly, at least at the time, cancels its February security updates, and then in March releases a bulletin detailing this WannaCry vulnerability. And then shortly after that, in April, presumably, you know, on the theory that, well, okay, they're starting to patch it, so this vulnerability is of no use to hackers anymore unless it's released into the wild now. It's sort of safe to burn it. It's not that valuable to keep it for them anymore. The Shadow Brokers published another batch of vulnerabilities. One of these was Eternal Blue, and then, you know, essentially within a month, we're seeing the sort of weapon, and not just the vulnerability, but the NSA sort of weaponized version of it. And then within, you know, weeks, essentially, we're seeing versions of that weaponized NSA code adapted into malware that is affecting computers around the world. Now, you know, there's a sense in which this is not their, you know, their fault, and that they didn't intend for that to happen. But I think it does sort of suggest that this is something that could have been avoided if this had been one. If, of course, if they had been better at securing their own tools, but two, if this is something that they had notified Microsoft about much, much earlier in the process. I mean, maybe they could have kept it for a few months to install spyware on some very high-value systems and then told Microsoft. There would have been a lot less of a window for that to leak out and for bad actors to exploit that. You know, but they would have even if it were independently discovered later, found that by then the vulnerability had been patched.
And the NSA, to the extent that they are willing to tell large companies or even smaller companies about vulnerabilities in their software, you seem to be indicating that they, in general, would only do so if somebody else got the exploit or if they were essentially done using that exploit.
You know, I mean, so they actually do tell companies a fair amount. So there's something called the vulnerabilities equities process, which is this process they use to determine when they discover a vulnerability. Do they keep it for themselves and use it to hack, or do they share it with the developer so it can be closed? And there's a lot of different factors that go into that, and they are supposedly trying to be more transparent about that process. And they say that already something like 90% of the things they discover, they pass on, you know, either directly or indirectly to the developers. But the trouble is 90% is not a very useful number. The question is what's the 90% they're sharing? Probably stuff that's not of any use to them. It's just, well, this could, you know, cause some harm, but it's not very helpful to someone who's trying to break into a system and steal data. The stuff that is high severity, they're of course much more tempted to keep, and you know, at some level, I don't blame them. I don't think that they should instantly necessarily hand over every single thing they discover. It makes sense if they want to briefly use something for some high value legitimate intelligence purpose. The problem is when you're talking about years, the longer something like that is kept under wraps, the higher the probability is either that it's going to be independently discovered or that, as in this case, as it turns out, your own tools will end up in the wild.
Julian Sanchez is a senior fellow at the Cato Institute. This holiday season, consider supporting the Cato podcast and the broad mission of the Cato Institute by visiting cato.org/podcast sponsor and learn more of the benefits of sponsorship. That's cato.org/podcast sponsor.